Hey guys, this is Kevin Estello of Fieldcraft Survival. I'm your host for this ad space right before the podcast. And I just want to take a couple minutes of your time to give thanks to Hoist. And Hoist is one of those hydration drinks that, you know, if you come here to North Carolina and you go into our fridge, you know, we'll often tell you like, hey, try this drink. It's from Hoist. Hey, we've got spares for the student, whatnot. People love Hoist and you can find it in all the supermarkets around here. It's one of those drinks that, you know, I get it. Water is good for you, but sometimes water can just be boring. And if it's boring, you're not going to drink it or there's a chance that you're not going to drink it. So if you have something with some flavor, then guess what? You're probably going to consume it. You're probably going to stay more hydrated. And when you are in our training courses, whether it's in the high humidity of the summer or it's in the dry air of the winter out in Utah, listen, you got to stay hydrated. So Hoist is one of those companies that we've partnered with. And they take care of our students and they're going to take care of you. Now, all you got to do is use the coupon FIELDCRAFT10, FIELDCRAFT10, and you can get 10% off of your order. As I already mentioned, there are ready to drink bottles that you can find in supermarkets. You can find them here in our North Carolina office. One of the things that I like is the powdered drinks mix. And the reason for that is because if I'm going out into the backcountry and I'm using, you know, my water treatment method, whether that's, you know, chemical pills or I'm using a filter or whatever, well, it doesn't always get rid of the flavor and Hoist does a pretty good job of masking that. So I know the water is safe to drink. I just want it to be better tasting to drink. So again, guys, please check them out. I use it. A bunch of the folks here at Fieldcraft use it. My buddy John, you know, who runs the Gray Farm. John is probably the biggest Hoist junkie I know. So check them out. Go to their website. Use the code FIELDCRAFT10. You'll get 10% off of your order. Also, just want to give a shout out to all the students who have come to our classes. Guys, it's been an exciting training year. We've run a lot of different classes all over. Jared, also known as Army Mace, has been teaching up in the Pacific Northwest. I've been up to SIG. I've been teaching all over out in Utah. A lot of sold out classes. I appreciate every one of you guys for coming out and training with me, training with my team, training with the good folks here at Fieldcraft. So shout out to all of you and hopefully you'll enjoy this podcast. So without further ado, let's get to it. Hey guys, what's going on? This is Kevin Estello with Fieldcraft Survival. You're listening to the Fieldcraft Survival podcast. Guys, I'm going to just jump right into this one. I'm just going to say some people, when you podcast them, they're not going to be a good interviewer. You know, or interviewee. And then some people, when you meet them, you're like, oh my God, I got to get this guy or this woman on the podcast because they're going to be awesome. Well, this is going to fall into the latter category. I was at Georgia Bushcraft a couple weeks ago. I'm standing at the booth for Badger Claw Outfitters and this dude walks by. He's there with his little daughter and I'm like, hey man, what's going on? You know, come on in, you know, let's talk. And we just started talking. And next thing you know, I was like, you need to be on the podcast because this guy's story is so damn interesting on so many different levels. And for those of you who are veterans and currently in the military, or I should say, and or currently in the military, I think you're going to appreciate his background. For those of you that are into homesteading, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, this guy's interesting. For those of you who just want to hear like a badass story of living, get ready for this one. So I want to introduce you to John Jackson. He runs Comfort Farms. He's affiliated with Stag Vets. We'll get into all that. And this dude is going to blow your mind. So, John, thanks for joining us on the podcast this morning.
Man, Kev, thanks for having me. That I would have to say that's probably the best damn introduction I've ever heard in my entire life.
Well, seriously, like I just try to keep it real, you know, like, you know, I could rehearse that over and over and over. I could try to sound like I'm a TV announcer and put on my TV announcer's voice, but it's like, dude, I just want to get right to it. Cause I mean, that's how we met. Like you were just walking by and I'm like, dude, come on in. And I had seen you earlier in the day, and let's just start off with this. I had seen you earlier in the day because I'm walking by the food court or the food area, and it looks straight out of fucking Game of Thrones. Like, like you had like animals just laid out and grilling. Like I was waiting for like, you know, the Dothraki to come in and just start killing people. Like it looked medieval, and I was like, this is so incredible. And then you came by later and I was like, I need to just talk to you because I'm a big foodie. But let's talk about that. So you were responsible for cooking for Georgia Bushcraft. And can we talk about your cooking first?
Yeah, man. So, first of all, I'm not a chef, right? I just kind of I call myself a farm cook, you know? And one of the biggest things that I kind of delve into was really cooking styles of all my my ancestors. And so, you know, I am a result of the transatlantic slave trade, with 80%, you know, from African countries, and the other 20% from European countries. Ironically, Viking. Okay, so part of a lot of that with me is just to understand more about who I am, is to really follow the food, and follow a lot of things. And I study really, really hard a lot of the food ways from in the South, but also from all these cultures. Most warriors were farmers first, right? I mean, it's just a great segue into fighting, because most farmers are into just really giving a sense of service that they're really not going to get the monetary value for. And so you kind of see where, you know, moving from farmer to warrior has always been, you know, it resonates throughout all cultures. And even in the US, you know, there are, you know, 75%, 75 to 80% of soldiers come from a rural background. So my cooking styles are really like in your face, you know, fire, smoke, coals, livestock on skewers, smoldering smoke, and really, really just bringing the reverence to the food, the flavors, the senses, everything. You know, it's like a show. You know, it's like a show, but more importantly, it's an extension of who I am inside.
And you take a look at the way that you were cooking and what you were cooking at that event, and then you compare that to, say, like fast food, right? Like
Oh, yeah.
we can go to Chick-fil-A, and look, I'm not gonna knock Chick-fil-A because I love Chick-fil-A,
Same.
but like I can't tell you the difference between a chicken sandwich that I got out in Utah to one that I got out here in North Carolina to one I got in Connecticut. Like they're all different, but there's no doubt when I talk about like the food that I saw at your place. I mean, I had a pulled pork sandwich and it was like, it was to die for. But I like, you know, there's something different about like your style of cooking compared to the big box stores and the ones that are like, that just pop up everywhere.
Yeah, man. Dude, I mean, all the food that we cook, there's stuff that we raise at the farm, right? And so when I you know, when I created the farm, I was also trying to create a I was also trying to create, you know, ways that we can get funding. And I found out that, you know, most farmers, they grow this amazing food, but they don't eat the food that they grow. And I thought that was just like, I'm like mind blowing. I'm like, how could you know, a lot of these farmers want premium price for their food. But how do you know it's premium if you don't eat it? And I get told, well, because it's too expensive for us to eat, which is extremely, extremely sad. I mean, first off, you have to feed yourself as a farmer and your family and your community, you know, in order to sustain, right? If you can't do that, then that's just not good. For me, having hands-on with all the livestock that we raise, and then being able to bring the love from the farm to the people, it's like I got to do these animals justice on every single way. And I think I do a pretty good job of, I put it like this, I feel good at the end of the day when I leave, and that attests to our team and the flavors that we represent and the attitudes of the people that eat our food.
You know, I think farmers are the equivalent of like the proud parent that pulls out photos. I mean, back in the day, pull out photos from their wallet. And now today it's like, oh, look at my daughter at dance, or look at my son at karate or whatever. Like farmers like talking about what they're able to produce. I mean, and the interesting thing is like my buddy George, back in Connecticut, he grows a lot of food in a small plot, and it's impressive when you hear just how much he can get. And then my buddy Jerry out here in North Carolina, I mean, he is up to his ears and pickles and jalapenos and whatnot. I think there's something to be said about, how, farmers are able to get from the land so much food. And I mean, I don't want to, this is going to start a flame war, I'm sure, but it's going to be very different than like going out and hunting where it's like, okay, you may be successful, you know, taking animal off the land, but you know, a farmer is going to do that in their backyard where you might have to go to a different plot. You might have to use so much more land to find one animal. That's not a guarantee, but if you do everything right with farming, there's a higher probability of a payout. And what I find interesting with farming too, and maybe you can shed some light on this. Like Jerry grew up in New York, moved down here to North Carolina. He's one of our top guys here at Fieldcraft, but he brought his interest in farming down here. And he's like, farming in the South, he said, is so much easier than it is farming in the North because of all the different growing seasons, because of the warmth. Mm-hmm. Your farm's in Georgia, right?
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about like the different farming that you have in the South compared to say like the Northeast or out West? Cause I don't think people realize that it has to be different based on the climate, the type of soil, what can and cannot be grown. Like, are you in like the ideal spot? Like what can you tell us about farming in the South?
Dude, man, that's a great question. Okay. So every region is unique, and most of our farming is all set up by zones, right? So you go to like the Almanac or USDA website, and you kind of say, hey, what zone am I in for farming? And it's going to tell you like way up north, you're probably in 4A, 5A, and 6A. And that's, you know, like 6A will probably be around, you know, Virginia, 5A, up like Pennsylvania, and so forth and so on. I'm in zone 8A. You're probably in North Carolina around 7A, depending on how close you are to Georgia, 7B. So between 7A, 7B, I'm going to say where your friend Jerry is farming at. So zone 8A, we have pretty much a full growing season from January all the way to December. We're growing food. Right. We can extend our crops with high tunnels and hoop houses to give warmth and things like that. But right now it's green season for us. You know, we go in the big, heavy greens. I'm growing about 17 different varieties of collard greens. I belong to the Heirloom Collard Green Association. So we're bringing back old heirlooms and really, really talking about, you know, the regional characteristics of those heirlooms. And then I sell them at my market. But greens are heavy right now. And especially, you know, anything that's kind of like in that brassica, the Latin term for a lot of these greens, especially collards, are brassicas. And so a lot of your brassicas do really, really great when you get like a really nice cold snap. You know, they crisp up and get much sweeter as the cold hits. And then we go right into, I'm going to start my tomatoes, eggplants, peppers right here at the end of December going into January. I mean, for us, because March is going to be coming really, really strong with some with a little bit warmer weather, and as the temperatures start growing, getting warmer in the soil, then we can start planting a lot. So yes, we have very, very productive soils, but the big thing is our soils never rest, and because of that, we don't necessarily have like northern soils where you see like that black organic matter that you would see up in the north, because the snow has come and everything is resting and everything has time to decompose. We don't have that here. A lot of our soils down here are sandy and clay base in the red soils. I, however, have gravitated toward how do I get back to, you know, more like northern style soils and using it a lot. And that's when I really started deep diving into indigenous ways and how our indigenous ancestors started the farm. And I've been able to achieve some amazing, amazing things. One more thing, our water in Georgia, we have aquifers that are amazing, right? And so let's just say, for instance, you go out west. If I take a gallon of water, let's just say out of Nevada aquifer, a gallon of water, or even California, it's going to take about 100 years to replace that 1 gallon of water in that aquifer. So that's significant. That's why there's a lot of drought. That's why you see, you know, a lot of fires and things like that going on, you know, in a lot of those regions. Here in Georgia, if I take 1 gallon of water out of our aquifers, it replenishes itself in one rainfall. So that's the difference. I mean, it's significant. And that's why we are experiencing a large agricultural shift from out west, where farmers in California and Texas and places like that are moving to Georgia because of our replenishful aquifers.
You know, you're making me homesick because I grew up in Connecticut, where Connecticut River Valley is known for black soil. I mean, we have the best tobacco wrappers in the world, hands down, period. Stop, right? Like, even Cuban cigars, they use Connecticut wrappers, right? So, so yeah, you're making me homesick. But I think one of the things that needs to be brought up, and you probably know more about this than I do, is that, you know, a lot of these people who, you know, tried farming over the years, centuries, some of them tried and failed because they didn't rotate crops and they didn't replace the nutrients in the soil and they depleted the soil. Like, is that part of what you're doing now where you rotate, like you said, 17 varieties of collard greens? I mean, do you rotate what you put in there to avoid that problem, or how does that work?
Man, you know, there are so many different types of growing methods. I mean, the rotation of crops have been a standard practice for the vitality of our soils, right? But there's this woman, her name is Dr. Elaine Ingram. I mean, she's an absolute beast when it comes to microbes in our soils, right? And she went down, like you said in the introduction of this podcast, you said, hey, I get right straight to it. Well, Dr. Elaine Ingram is the same way. She gets straight to it. And what she has now said, that what we thought was right about like rotation of crops, is actually not all that true. And really? She breaks it down. Yeah. And what she breaks it down is, she said, we have two types of let's say agricultural systems. One of those agricultural systems is fungal dominated, and the other one of those agricultural systems is bacteria dominated, right? So look at your plains. Let's go back out to where the bison roam, right? Those plains are nothing but like, it's just straight grasses, different varieties of grasses. They're all there. Well, the symbiotic relationship between those grasses and the livestock are that the bison go out, or cows, right? They go out, they eat those grass, they poop, that manure goes back into the soil. That's a bacterial dominated field. And so when you understand the microbes in your system, you understand that you don't necessarily need to replace them. Think about trees. Trees are fungal dominated. So trees you can compare trees to squash, to any type of fruiting thing, right? That's going to happen, like tomatoes, you know, eggplant, peppers, those type of things. If your soils are more fungal dominated, you don't have to go and replace them. And in theory, what she's saying is that you can grow corn in the same spot year after year after year after year, and it will become better because you're paying attention to the microbes in that soil that will cause that corn to have less disease, less affected by drought, because it's building up these trillions and trillions and trillions of in quadrillions of cities underneath the soil to make that happen. So that's the new thinking from a very, very ancient way of doing things, if that makes sense.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's mind blowing.
But you know, like, I've heard people say like everything works until it doesn't, and that's the way we've always done it until someone else does it differently. Well, you know, I'm open to listening to this woman, because if you're telling me she's a beast of a woman in terms of that, I'll listen. And, you know, I've also learned to listen to women who are just simply beasts. They'll probably beat me up. So, you know, I think part of your story that we should jump into is, obviously you're known for farming, you're known for what you do now, but you have a backstory, which you alluded to. And there's that old expression, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. And what I think is interesting is your background. So for those that are listening, can you kind of give us the history of you joining the military, what you did, and kind of how you kind of brought yourself back to where you are today?
Yeah, man. You know, I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, and right across from Liberty State Park. You know, that was my childhood. I was going through a divorce at the time, you know, or separation at the time, and those towers went down, man, and so did my childhood. And so it was one of those things where I just really kind of felt you know, I needed to do something new. I needed to engage myself. I was, you know, I was feeling, you know, depressed about the relationship, you know, and yeah, all those type of things. And, but at that time, country needed everyone, you know, to really kind of, get together. And so I joined the military. And, when I first got in, I was with 3rd ID, 115 Infantry, and we went into Iraq in 2005. These boys went in; they were the first to go in. They did some crazy stuff, man. And you know, they came back, sat back for a year, and then that's when the insurgency took over when they were gone. And so, it had such a stronghold; they had to go back. So I went back on the second wave of one of the hardest hit units, you know, in the Army at that time. I spent two deployments with them. I did a 13-month and a 15-month deployment. And those deployments really, that's where I lost. My first deployment is where I lost all my innocence as a person. You know, I went from Johnny with all my friends who knew me to John, right? John is very different from Johnny, you know? And, you know, I remember watching myself, my young self, my innocent self, that all the purity. I remember the day I lost my innocence, you know, and it was at war, right? And what I had to become and what I had to do to survive that space and really kind of get my mindset in a space where I knew that I will be doing this until I die, was another transformational change for me that that I just had to do what I had to do and become in a mindset that was just that wasn't I would say American friendly or socially acceptable, you know, because that's what we have to be when we're over at war. And we're out there chasing down, hunting down monsters, doing the things that we need to do, and the people that we have to be and what our country calls us to be are not necessarily the people that they really want to associate with. And that's a big calling when you are, it's a big ask, put it like that, when you ask soldiers to go to war and what they have to do. And as a result of that, I came back. My second marriage at the time from over 10 years, my wife, she called me up. Well, I called her up on sat phone when I was with the Rangers and just talked to her, man. And she pretty much divorced me over the phone. She just didn't see an end in sight. And it gutted me, man. I felt eviscerated. And, you know, that really kind of led me down a really dark place because she was the person I fought for. You know, my family was I wanted to come back home. And so I did my job every single day to make sure that I get back home with my wife. But what I wasn't seeing on her end was her having the anxiety of the black trucks and black SUVs showing up at her door to tell her, hey, you know, your husband was lost. And that stress for as long as I did it, you know, 40 months overseas for the first 8 years was a lot to put on just one person. And she didn't sign up for that. And I forgave her for that. And then I had to move on. But as a result, I was in the deepest, darkest pit of my mind. And I almost took my life, man. At one point, you know, I was literally sitting there watching my last sunset, and had my son not walked in that room, literally, I would have taken my life. And I didn't play the tape all the way through. It was one of those things that was really, I felt like I had a second chance at really trying to pull myself together. And as a result of that, I made a commitment not only to myself, but to every veteran that I'm not going to allow another vet who's going through hard times not to have anybody to talk to. And so that's when I created the nonprofit Stag Vets Inc., Strength to Achieve Greatness, and created the first program out of that called Comfort Farms, named after my Ranger buddy, Collie Comfort, who got killed in combat on May of 2010. I pulled him off the battlefield, off the berg, and He was a good friend of mine. And really the philosophy under Comfort Farms is that we only grow in our discomfort, not in our comfort. He didn't become a ranger because he wanted a comfortable job. He chose the most hardest thing he could do. And that's our philosophy for all our vets.
Man, there's a lot to unwrap in what you just said. And, you know, I kind of want to continue along the lines of discomfort for a moment. And I know better never to ask what you saw or what it was that made you have that transformation. But I think the more appropriate question to ask is, how did that change the way you felt? Like, how did you start seeing the world differently as warning signs for someone who might be going through something right now where they're going through that transition of feeling, you know, feeling differently from being through such trauma? Like, what was it that you were kind of cueing in on or didn't notice until, you know, that moment, like you said, you almost took your life? Like, what could people be aware of where they're like, man, I'm seeing the world differently and it's not a good thing. I'm going down a dark path.
Yeah, man. So I might get choked up on this because every time I kind of open up those these portals, right, that go back into my life, I remember the feelings. They're so visceral, you know, as if it just happened, right?
Yeah.
So for the sake of helping other people in having your audience understand, we'll go there, right? So the biggest thing is loss of humanity, right? What does it mean for us to be human? You know, it's love, it's caring, it's anger, right? It's anxiety, it's all the things, you know, that we have, that we experience, right? Losing those feelings, never being able to cry again over your buddy who just got, you know, his brain shot out or blown up, and you're picking up, you know, wiping off brain matter and cleaning up teeth, you know, but you can put that destroyed vehicle back together in 24 hours and you just kind of pour this dude into a body bag and, you know, you're sending him off, right? You got to build the calluses that are so tough to build in at first, so that way you can do your job, you know, in a couple hours and the next day and keep on going, because you know it's going to be you got to get home, you got to do what you need to do. So the more that happens, the more callous that you build, right? And the more you create and build this, you know, you go from a 1 foot wall up to 20 foot wall, and nothing is going to come over that wall because you've built your protective structure around you. Understanding that when you take a break, you know, in war, that's a perfect time to operate, right? You know, really having no feelings, no emotions, being able to respond to contact and do the things that you need to do without having those things weigh you down, right? That's what we have to do. That's what every warfighter has to do who joins the military. They go to combat, they do what they have to do, but there's consequences around that. And those consequences really manifest themselves when you get home, because I wasn't as caring to my kids or my wife at the time. Wasn't caring. I was just very emotionless. And a lot of veterans and especially combat vets who've experienced this understand that once your emotions get involved, people get hurt because you're not laser beamed on that. The caveat to this, which is really, really scary, is that when you do start to develop those emotions, now you feel, and it's just a natural process, now you feel that your edge is not as sharp. And we all know what it means to have our edges not as sharp, because people die, people get hurt. And so now you have this conflict inside of you that you're like, I'm not at war, I'm at home, but my body and my mind is making me feel this certain type of way. And what we end up doing is going towards self-medication to numb the pain, to numb the noise, right? So drugs and alcohol are huge within veteran society, because most of the VA people there really can't talk to you about, like, you know, what you're going through. They've never been, you know, and they just want to hear stories. And when you go back to them, it's somebody new. So you got to tell your story all over again. And a lot of vets just say, you know, F this, man, I'm just going to take care of myself. And that's the spiral that they go down, that they go down. And so I understood that. I understood where I was at my worst space. And I understand that I lost my humanity. And like I said, I became a monster to my family. I became a monster to the people around me. And I always say to, like, I was talking to a general now about this, who I went to combat with, and we talked about these type of things. And he was wondering about, like, the suicide rate in the special operations field. It's getting higher, you know. And I was explaining this the same thing to him, that who better to kill the monsters than the monster killers themselves? Especially when you become a monster, you feel that it's your duty to take yourself out in a lot of these cases. And that's the part that a lot of people don't understand. And so what I'm trying to do is really kind of show people a sense of community, a sense of purpose within themselves, that, hey, it's okay to feel broken. That's the part, those are the steps that we take into getting back to the person, getting back to this new individual that we can love and appreciate, that what we have to offer to not only ourselves, but our families and our friends and our community, that our job is not done. Even though we're not at war, we still have a lot of work to do, because our communities, our country continue to need us, especially those young, impressionable children. And more so, the leadership that our wives want from us. So it's not an easy thing, you know, climbing. You know, we thought the Mount Everest literally was climbing and getting to war, but no, the Mount Everest for us is coming back and becoming human again. And that doesn't have to be a very hard, difficult process. It's a process that once we understand all the emotions and we settle with it, those emotions are what makes us human again. And so even on the farm, you know, we use what we call a covert curriculum, really, on the farm, where vets think they're here for farming, but they're not. They're here learning life skills. They're here building up those things with animals and livestock that are very similar to human interactions, but it's also an easy path to take with being emotionally involved with raising an animal and then slaughtering it and crying over that, which you would never do with a human, because that's where the trauma began. And so my goal is to help veterans understand themselves, like I've learned to understand and love myself.
This episode is brought to you by BioPro Plus. Why do our hormones suck as we get older? Our human growth hormone and its derivative of growth factors can reduce by 50% by age 35. And it doesn't matter how hard you train, how good you eat. If we don't have the proper hormones in our body, we're not going to get the results we want. BioPro Plus is the first of its kind non-synthetic alternative to prescription human growth hormone. All the benefits of synthetic HGH without any of the needles, side effects, or doctor's visits. Guys, that's the ad that I'm supposed to read, and it's the truth. But I've been on BioPro myself for a year and a half, and it has drastically changed my life, my fitness, and my health in general. I suffer from traumatic brain injury from years of blast overpressure, working with explosives, and I don't suffer from any of the side effects anymore. My fitness is better than it's ever been, and I'm going to be 45 next week. So head on over to bioproteintech.com. Click on the link, use code FIELDCRAFT for $30 off your first order. Don't take it from me, go try it yourself.
You know, part of addressing a problem, the first step in addressing a problem is recognizing that there is one. And I think sharing some of those red flags is so important. We had a guy on the podcast, a good friend of mine, when he was in the process of working on his PhD, Dr. Dan Luna. And Dan was a Navy SEAL, and his work and his PhD was all about pre-trauma. Like, how do we get people ready to experience trauma? And then, you know, your work that you're doing is post-trauma, and it's so important that, like, everyone starts working together and sees it for this big picture. It's like, you will see terrible things. You will experience this, be aware of what's going to happen to you when you get over there. And as it's happening, open up. And it's okay to talk about it because they have to realize that they're not the only ones who have experienced that over the years. You know, the work that you're doing is so fascinating to me because, like you said, when you put your blood, sweat, and tears into a product, but then you're able to share it with someone and see the joy that that person has, even if it's momentary, like mm-hmm. the taste of food, like there's something powerful there. So can you kind of explain like the early stages, like when they come to the farm and they're involved in the process, what exactly, like what do you notice? Like what's the transformation that takes place when they go through your program?
Well, one of the things that really draws hard, or one example, because there's many examples, but this one example that really gets to me is I had a dude. He was in the special operations community, and he needed to get away. He needed to get away from everything, job, wife, people, everything. He came in, and I saw how tense he was, and what I did was not play on his how intense he was. It was just provide him with clear direction of what duties we have for the day, right? It was, hey, 6:30, we're up rocking and rolling on, you know, feeding chickens. This is what we're doing with the hogs. We're going to be building this. We're working on this irrigation. We're going to have lunch. Then we'll have dinner. And then, you know, we'll do it again the next day. Never talked to him about his issues, never talked to him about those things because he was just clearly upset and mad. But he got on the farm and he worked like a daggone ox. I mean, just into it, dusty every day, sweat, just putting it in. And I kind of knew around day four, I wanted to address his thing. And I remember rolling out of the space here. And I sat and I called him over. I said, hey, man, I said, seems like you're in a little bit of better headspace than you were on the first day you got here. I said, how you feeling now, man? And he was like, dude, I don't even know what I was so upset about, you know, just really like the farm took it out of him and he took it out on the farm. And I tell people that, you know, Comfort Farm is built on anxiety and depression. You know, the beauty around you is what vets put into it because it absorbs all those things, just like Mother Nature intended it to be, right? And so when we sit down and we contribute to the food on the table and the work that we have done, we know without a doubt that this, with full intention, that we are giving the best of ourselves and sharing the best of ourselves with everyone else. And even if the meal sucks, it's just, even if it sucks, man, it just, it's like, we're happy to sit down. We're happy to be in each other's, you know, like embrace each other as human beings, as people. And it's really not about the food, man. It's more about the association and being able to smile again and be happy about something again.
Wow. And you have a culminating activity that you were telling me about at Georgia Bushcraft that I was like, I really hope the Utah crew will send a film crew there, maybe send me just to be like an observer and watch the whole thing. And I don't speak French, but it was something de monde, right? Like of the mountain.
Yeah.
Can you explain that? Because that sounds wild to me in terms of like the whole process and just kind of go through like what that event is all about. Because you said it's already sold out, right?
No, it will sell. So we have early bird tickets that are coming out right now. And so early bird tickets go all the way through December 1st. And but then after that, those tickets, we only invite 350 people to the event, or allow 350 people to the event. So they'll still be tickets by the time this airs. We just, the hardcore people that come in, they always get the the VIP tickets and whatnot, you know? So, so let me talk to you about this event. This is a 3-day event. It's called the Le Pied du Mont Boucherie. And so we live in the Piedmont area of Georgia. That's French for the type of region that we live in. It's also Italian, but we decided to own the French because, the word butcher is boucher, right? Boucher. And so boucherie is a festival. It's what a lot of, I would say indigenous communities, and even more importantly, I'm looking at too, a lot of enslaved Africans who came over towards the South and in Louisiana sharing their traditions. Because when I was in Zimbabwe working on a show that's coming up next year called Seekers, we did a boucherie in Zimbabwe that we had no idea was going to happen. And it was about three to four weeks before my boucherie here. So it was an interesting dynamic of what took place, almost exactly what happened with an indigenous group over in Africa to where we were, what we were doing here. And so Le Pied du Mont Boucherie is the butcher at the foot of the mountain. And we do this festival where we bring in the reverence of our veterans, man. We have what we call the platoon. I have Kyle Comfort with his helmet, rifle, and his boots standing out there in center. And behind him is about 45 boots representing veterans who've passed. And they are who we're honoring that weekend. You know, those veterans are there up in front and center throughout the whole boucherie festival, and people come in, pay homage. You know, they really understand that, you know, we want to bring their spirits into this space, because at the end of the day, I can say now, if I lost my life overseas in combat, I don't want anybody crying over me. I want them celebrating that they have their freedoms. And so one of the things, that's what we do, and that's where we started with. We bring in farmers, butchers, chefs from all over the world. They come into this space. And on that Friday, it's for VIPs only, we do humane slaughter. So we teach a chef, a butcher, and a farmer what the livestock is that they're going to be working with through the weekend. And we go ahead and put that animal down humanely, right? So we really, really focus on the care of that animal and actually how to do this right. A lot of people pay for this event to come because if they ever have to put an animal down, I don't want people bludgeoning, you know, animals with like sledgehammers and things like that. I mean, that's just barbaric, and we're better than that. So there's ways on how we can do this, and we teach those ways. And people are extremely, extremely surprised at the level of efficiency that we do towards this. We have a vet on site. She's from Michigan. She comes down every year, brings her crew, and she teaches other veterans about these things. We go through every part of the animal from nose to tail, and all those dishes are being made throughout the whole weekend as part of an education to have people understand that, hey, there's more than just the ribeye, and there's more than just the pork chop, right? So, I mean, you'll see me. I love making ponce, which is taking the pig's stomach and making sausage out of that. When I'm down in Louisiana with my buddy Brian Kaiser, who I do this work with, you know, I'm from up north, man. And when I make this ponce especially down in Louisiana, these Cajuns, you know, this one Cajun, he walked over, he tasted it, and he just stopped and he looked at me and he said, "What's your coon ass?" No, he goes, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Jersey." You know, he says, "What's your coon ass from Jersey know how to make a ponce?" And I was like, man, you know, anywhere else that would be like totally, like offensive. But man, to be called a coon ass in Louisiana is like, you're one of the people, bro. You know what I'm saying? So, so being able to bring cultural foods to the folks and using every part of that animal to include all the guts and everything and make these dishes absolutely amazing is what this is all about, man. We celebrate life, right? We celebrate the fact that our veterans fought for our freedoms, for us to still congregate without fear, you know, and we celebrate our farmers for going out there working their butts off just to provide food on the plate. And for them, you know, it's a thankless job. We celebrate our chefs. We celebrate our butchers for doing what they need to do to get this stuff to retail and out there. And also we celebrate our industry leaders that support us, that sponsor this event year in and year out, because those are the folks who are leading the way with regards to what we call compassionate capitalism, you know, because they care and they support the backbone of our communities, which are our small family farms.
You know, shifting gears just for a second, you know, we'll get back to the mission and everything, talking about celebration of the animal. You know, I think there are so many people out there that, like you said, everyone wants that ribeye, everyone wants that pork chop, everyone wants the tenderloins. Like, I just got a text message from an old Fieldcraft buddy, George Bell, and he's like, yeah, I just took a deer with the crossbow. And I think, you know, it didn't take me more than 30 seconds to reply, like, hey, you're having backstraps tonight or tenderloins, you know, but there's so many interesting parts of that animal that are delicious. And there are other parts of different animals and other animals that you find around the farm that become these amazing dishes. So you're talking about making a meal out of the stomach. Well, that's very similar to what they do with haggis, right?
In Scotland, absolutely.
Which is delicious. Like, if you were to tell someone, hey, we're going to take a stomach and fill it with this, you'd be like, oh, that's gross. Well, if you just ate it blindly and was like, hey, what do you think of this? The taste is amazing. I think there are so many good foods out there that people are so afraid to try. And it's like, if you don't like it, don't finish it. Give it to someone else. But try it. You might like it. Like, I feel like a mom or a dad telling your kid, like, try your freaking Brussels sprouts, you know? Is there, like, aside from that meal that you just talked about that the Cajun liked, what are some of the other ones that, like, the everyday man or everyday woman could make when they go hunting or they go fishing? Like, what's something that you would say, like, oh, you got to try this, you know, just try it because you might like it.
Yeah. So one of the greatest things about this event is that if you come here, you have the opportunity to literally learn how to make everything, right? So let's take, for instance, a smoked sausage. Mm-hmm. Okay. You can go ahead and you can really kind of focus on what the team is doing that's making sausage. You know, what are the techniques for making sausage? Why is he using that cold bowl? They'll tell you. You know, why is your ground to fat ratio this way? They'll tell you, they'll show you. Matter of fact, they'll pull you in and say, hey, this is what I need you to do, right? So this is a hands-on event for the most part. We're going to be there. We're going to, you know, like, I'll go back to making sausage is probably one of the best things that everybody can learn, because if you're killing a deer or you're killing a boar, right, you want to be able to, you know, make sausage traditional way, be able to smoke that sausage and, you know, or cold smoke. We have a cold smoker here on the farm. We talk about like a fish. We cold smoke fish. How do you make a cold smoke fish dip, right? Well, we'll show you. You know, the beauty about it too is the use of vegetables over live fire in many different applications, and also the pair with foods. We have stuff like crackling. I mean, everybody loves crackling, right? And there's a point of even where you can take just not only, you know, the fat from the pig with a little meat, they call them gratons down in Louisiana, but how do you go ahead and render that fat out of that in order to get it beautiful and crispy? we have stuff like fraisiers, you know, where, you know, how do you cook the intestines and the organs and make a soup out of those things, right? But more importantly, what to look for after a kill. You're going to find that most of our animals, like if you're growing organically like I'm doing, you're probably going to have a higher parasite load than you would from a deer or wild boar in the lungs and in the liver in places like that. Because see, our animals, even though we grow them organically, they don't have the ability to move around like deer and wild boar do, right? They're still on that same ground. But one of the things that we look at, and once we open up that carcass, you know, we have our team of experts that are right there that are looking at those lungs and telling people, hey, this is what you get when, right? Or the liver, hey, this is an excellent liver. This is not so excellent liver, right? And showing people right there what to look for, especially when you're going out on a kill. I have a preclinical background in pharmaceutical research, and my main job was necropsies and reproductive toxicology, teratology. So I'm all in the animals. I'm there. They call me all the time when they have something weird want to look at, you know? And so, but these are like valuable, valuable things that anybody with any level of from novice to advanced will appreciate, because it just gives you an insight onto how to use the animal, how to use all of its parts, and what to look for in case of disease.
My buddy, Mike O'Brien, he's out in Utah. He actually made it very far into the selection process for a network television show that was going to be all about cooking wild game. But then they found out that, you know, he carries a pistol and he believes in the Second Amendment, and they canned him. They're like, well, you can shoot animals and you can fish, but you can't carry a pistol, whatever. Well, he was brought out recently for one of our events, and he showed guys how to humanely dispatch rabbits and rabbit three ways. They made like a rabbit stew, fried rabbit, and I did something else. There is something to be said about that whole process of breaking out an animal. Like, there's a demand for it like I've never seen before. And I mean, I've taught classes like professionally as a survival instructor since 2007. I have never seen so many people message me and say, hey, when are you doing a kill class? When are you doing a butchering class? And all I can say is, like, we're currently populating the calendar of courses, but go talk to your local environmental protection agency, like not EPA, like conservation. Like in Connecticut, we had Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. They call it DEEP. And, you know, then there's NCON and, you know, all these different organizations. You can learn a lot from people who volunteer their time. It sounds like you're super passionate about it.
Oh, yes.
But I could tell. But I, you know, sticking with this idea of like learning about our food, but moving from animals to plants, you mentioned the TV show that you did called Seekers. But more important than just the TV show and, you know, the Hollywood drama and all that stuff that they're going to create is actually the subject of the show. And I love the idea that you did a lot of research into these ancient, you know, grains, these ancient seeds. Can you talk about the difference between like knowing that you're using something that can be traced back long ago compared to the genetically modified stuff today? And I don't know if that's a hot button topic for you or not, but how do you feel about like some of these plants that are growing like way too large for what they should be compared to like the organic stuff, the stuff that you can trace way, way back?
Yeah, man. Oh, dude, I'm a seed geek, right? I save seeds and I go across the damn planet on finding seeds of my culture and heritage to tell the stories of those indigenous communities. So one of the things that you have to understand, and like I try to tell people, is that a lot of these GMO varieties that we primarily have in our stores today where we eat, just walk into the supermarket and stop and look. And look how everything is just perfect. Everything is just shiny. Everything is just the perfect size. And you won't see nature anywhere in those places that sell us food. That's a huge red flag. Because nature don't make straight lines, period. Okay? Nature, things are born out of stress. Things have survived out of stress. And the fruit from those things, that's what has carried on ancient civilizations from millennia to millennia because of the stresses of the environment. The food that we eat now has not undergone any stress. They're hit with so many pesticides and herbicides, that way they can grow in a very comfortable situation. Because we as Westerners, especially like in the US, and I'll say Westerners for the most part, because it's almost like a disease. We want convenience, and we're ready to give our up freedoms for convenience. And so when I go back to seeds of ancient times, these were stewarded by civilizations that were around, I mean, in a time that was perilous, and they created an agricultural base to feed empires. And there was no GMO modification. What they used to create the best was through observation. They looked and they saw, you know, like for instance, the North Georgia candy roaster that is a quintessential pumpkin of Georgia, that also ran with the Cherokee Nation, that was stewarded by the Cherokee Nation, is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, almost over 1,000-year-old pumpkin variety that grows here in the Southeast. That particular pumpkin does not deal with or is better suited for disease, unlike it doesn't catch like the vine borer. If you ask anybody that grows pumpkins or squash, they have vine borer issues. You know, they have all these pumpkin squash bugs and things like that that are always destroying their plants. Well, this particular pumpkin, the North Georgia candy roaster, does not have those issues because the indigenous population of Cherokee were stewarding these plants for the right type of climate, and they knew what they were looking for. And so with that, you want to talk about plants that are resilient to climate change. Well, how many droughts has those pumpkin seeds been through? How many winters have they been through? I mean, they've been through it all. And so they've arrived to us as a gift, not as a curse. They've arrived to us because Mother Nature has said, here you go, take these plants and continue on with that line. And that gets me back to seedless varieties, right? Because of convenience, and we don't want to spit seeds out of a watermelon, or any other type of seedless variety. I would say this, that most of the seedless varieties are not done under GMO circumstances. They are natural in a way where scientists understand how to breed these particular ones to become seedless. But here's the thing. If you get a seedless variety, that means Mother Nature rejected it. It doesn't want it to pass on that prodigy. Really? So what you're essentially eating is food that Mother Nature rejects herself. So not to say that, you know, I mean, people who eat seedless varieties, you know, they don't want to spit out seeds, but think about it. There's a reason why it's sterile and why Mother Nature doesn't want it to produce.
Dude, you're making me rethink like all these fish that are introduced into the wild for sport fishing, like eating fish that are not able to reproduce. Like,
yes.
Why There's the hell am reason. I doing that?
There is a reason.
Dude, why did you ruin my Tuesday? Damn.
But what I want us to understand, Kevin, is that, you know, in some applications, right? In some applications, you know, with regards to sport fishing and things like that, you know, a lot of these things had good intentions, right? You know, they had good intentions because they wanted to limit the amount of wild species that were caught that would almost be eradicated, right? And people want to fish, and so they give them these things. But the main thing is we cannot deny that the spirit of these animals, of all of its entirety, right, are definitely connected to nature. And there's a reason why certain things Mother Nature will not allow to reproduce, even though they can do it naturally. You know, like your white bass and your stripers will produce a hybrid. You know, that happens naturally within nature, but there's a reason why they won't produce. And as long as we know the why and we understand that, then, you know, we're free to kind of, you know, shift left or shift right where we want to. But regardless, with vegetables, I am very, very more apprehensive to eat food that are not allowed or not you know, are, how can I say this? I'm very apprehensive eating food that Mother Nature says you will not be able to breathe.
Wow. That is the heaviest thing I've heard in a long time. And now I'm going to adopt that myself, because that makes absolute sense to me.
Well, if you think about this, if you go back to our common ancestor, right? Our common ancestor, how they survived and the things that they did, it was based on the food and based on what Mother Nature gave them at the time. Okay. And you can only get that through seeds. When I was with the Punave, you know, they look in the Amazon, they revered the piranha. The piranha is for vitality, right? The piranha, you eat that, it's just to kind of, it's that powwow. You know, that's what they always say. You get that powwow, right? The women at the village hated it when we brought back all this piranha, because they're just like, oh my God, these men, you know? And that's just how they felt. If you took into all the animals within the Amazon with the indigenous folks, if you told them that this one wasn't able to breed, they would think that they've been cursed by God. Because, or the creator, you know, because what do you mean the animal can't breed? We breed because the animals breed, you know, and it's just a foreign thing. But Western society and culture, we have really done a great job of making things convenient for our sake. But what we do is take out the spirituality of why those things exist in the natural world in the first place.
Wow. You know, we're coming towards the end of the podcast. I just got to ask you advice. And what the advice I'm going to ask you, because you've talked about two different types of lives that you've lived. You lived the life of the farmer and the soldier. And if you are someone who's listening and you haven't been paying attention to the news, it seems like the world is kind of teetering on the verge of another war. And there's no doubt that there's going to be a demand for people to go overseas again. But then also at the same time, there's going to be a demand to grow your own food, much like we've been talking about. So if you had to give advice to an 18-year-old who is trying to go two different routes, or one, like two 18-year-olds, one going the route of the soldier and one 18-year-old going the route of the farmer, what advice do you give to each of those people?
Oh, man.
Dude, I always end with a bang, you know?
Yes. I'm sitting here looking at my 18-year-old self, man, you know, and what I know now. Man, so what I would give, the advice that I would give is that that calling of service in you to do either is very important. Our food security is just as important as our national security. You know, you can't feed your, you know, if you're going to the farming way, you got to understand that to do it right, you can't feed the world doing it the way that you can, but you can feed your community. And if you inspire more people within your space, they will in turn feed their communities. And the more people we get feeding our communities, we'll eventually end up feeding the world. As a soldier going in, your sense of service, pour gasoline on it. Go in, be hard charging, learn as much as you can. Because your sense of service, whether you're serving food or whether we're serving our country, is really on the same level. And it doesn't require mediocrity within this work. Be a consummate professional, learn as much as you can, and be a subject matter expert on anything that you touch. And that's just my advice for what I would tell my 18-year-old self, which I've unknowingly followed.
Yeah, I wish I had the ability to go back in time and talk to myself and say, you know what? You know, listen to this person a little bit more closely. Appreciate their words of wisdom while you have them in your life. I wish I could do that. So unfortunately I can't. And now I'm just looking to gain good knowledge from people who I can still talk to. And I think that's important. So there's no doubt that I want to continue this relationship with Fieldcraft and Comfort Farms. There's no doubt I want to continue sharing your message, because I think what you're doing is really amazing work. And I think that's why we connected initially at George Bushcraft. And yeah, I was like, dude, tell me more. Like, tell me more. Like I was a sponge, and like, I get a chance to interview some really cool people and some interesting people, but I was genuinely like it hit on so many levels. I was like, I need to know more. So if anyone is listening and they want to follow Stag Vets, they want to follow Comfort Farms, they want to follow you, I'm not going to give them your phone number, because I know that if you call your phone number, you're going to get a message that's going to say, I get a lot of spam messages. Text me if you really want to talk. But how can people, and by the way, guys, that is really what happened just before this podcast. I was like, oh crap. Like, I'm not going to be able to get through to John. How can people get in touch with you? What can they do to follow you, and how can they support what you're doing?
Yeah, man. Thank you so much, too, for inviting me on this and connecting me to your audience. And would love to do some further stuff. And the best way to connect with me is through Facebook and Instagram, right? So Comfort Farms on Facebook and Comfort Farms on Instagram. The email that we have, I have an admin, April. She's on that all the time. If she's not available, I will definitely be available. But info@stagvetsinc, stagvetsinc.org. You know, we have it set up where, you know, groups can come in. You know, we have lodging on the farm for, you know, where we can house about 10 people, 38 acres on the farm. Most of it's wooded, so that way we can take care of all of our majority of our pollinators and, you know, and wildlife. We have an amazing ability to do things on the farm that pretty much anybody would want to do as far as teaching and learning. And I encourage everyone to make a boucherie with us. Put it on your schedule. It's always the ML Martin Luther King birthday weekend every year, that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So people start showing up on Thursday. They get Airbnbs around here. There's local hotels. People camp out here too, right? So primitive camping is allowed. But yeah, so make a boucherie. If you want a life-changing, soulful event with amazing stuff going on, make a boucherie. And our upcoming boucherie is going to be in January. Check to see, look at Georgia Boucherie Festivals, the website, and check to see if you want to sponsor or if you want to join us for that weekend. It's going to be a very, very special weekend.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being an awesome podcast guest. I just got to say this, like, people who have listened to this podcast for a while know when I'm like working really hard to get an answer out of a guest, but like, yeah, you are so fluent with your knowledge. Like, there's no doubt you're an SME in your area, and you know, it's just enjoyable listening to this. And I'm hoping that anyone that is listening or has listened to this will comment, you know, where they can comment on our social media, they'll reach out to you. They'll just continue spreading this message, because like I said, I think it needs to be heard. So I really can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Thank you, brother. And now I'll definitely, during my delivery routes, I always listen to podcasts, dude. I can't wait to pull you up and just get some great information while I'm on the road, man.
Well, thanks so much, John. And thank you guys for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I've been your host, Kevin Estella. Until next time.